From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Steven Pinker has a sledgehammer, and he's using it. He's out to shatter society's long-held beliefs about everything from evil to intelligence, instincts to parenting. He's out to demolish the blank slate theory that we all come into the world pure and dewy, ready for the world to shape us for good or ill. Forget about it, says the MIT psychologist and best-selling author in his red-hot new blockbuster, The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. Pinker says science has made our nearly religious devotion to the idea of the blank slate now unnecessary, even incoherent. Is violence a learned behavior? Pinker says no. Is gender identity a social construction? No again. Biological differences between the sexes, he says, are profound and clear. Wake up, world, shouts Pinker. Humanity is not a lump of clay. This is the way things are, how we really are. Are you ready to turn away from the blank slate and embrace genetic code as the primary human reality? Do you worry that a biological understanding of the human mind will be used to justify inequality or subvert social change? Is this the end of idealism or the honest, informed beginning? Should we honor Steven Pinker or burn him at the stake? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now in the studio is Steven Pinker. He's professor of psychology at MIT and author of The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. Good evening and welcome, Steven Pinker.
Thank you.
It's great to have you.
Thank you.
Also in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, great to have you here in the flesh.
Thank you. Nice to see you.
With all your human nature.
Yeah, I bring it with me.
It's with us all. Steven Pinker, you write that contemporary human beings tend to see human nature as a dangerous idea. What's the evidence for that?
Well, an example would be all of the research purporting to demonstrate the effects of parenting that measures some correlation between what parents do and how their children turn out. Parents who bathe their children in language have children with more advanced language skills. Parents who spank their children have kids who grow up to be violent in their turn. Parents who talk to their children, their teenagers, have teenagers who are less likely to be on drugs. Everyone assumes that the parents cause the personality trait in the child. Now, that might be true, but there's an alternative explanation that's rarely tested, which is that since parents bequeath genes to their children as well as an environment, the correlations by themselves could merely be showing us that talkative people have talkative kids and violent people have violent kids and conscientious people have conscientious kids.
So maybe our parenting doesn't make the child, and I hear that, we'll get into that, but I have to say, I just love this book. It was such a feast for the mind, but it's very provocative. And I'm still curious about this central tenet. I mean, you describe the kind of entire worldview that most of us live in as what I took as a kind of parallel to the Pope looking at Galileo and saying, what you're saying is upsetting me, can't possibly be true. You know, I'm going to hang you by your thumbs. You're saying our entire worldview is based on this notion that we're a blank slate, that we can be shaped for our own best interests, for the social good. You're saying, wait a minute. But when you say that, you're also pointing out that humans find it dangerous, that they find human nature itself a dangerous idea. And that seems counterintuitive to me. To contemporary people, what looks dangerous about human nature?
One is the people see it as a threat to the ideal of equality. The one advantage of the blank slate in people's minds comes from the simple mathematical fact that zero equals zero. If we're all born with nothing, by definition, we're all the same. If we're born with something, then some people can have more of it than others, and the thought is that that opens the door to inequality. Now, I argue that, in fact, political equality is not a factual hypothesis that people are clones. It's the political ideal that we recognize certain universal rights in people, and it's a policy to treat people as individuals rather than prejudging them by the traits of some group that they belong to. But nonetheless, there's a lazy shortcut to political equality, and that's to say that people can't possibly differ. That's one of the reasons that it's considered dangerous to acknowledge human nature, and there are others.
Is the Declaration of Independence then a lazy shortcut?
No, because it's very clear that the Declaration and the man who wrote the words of the Declaration, mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson, did not actually believe that we were clones, but rather that we are equivalent in certain rights. And he spelled it out, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And not more than that, at least in the text.
That's right. And in fact, Jefferson wrote, even though putting aside the fact that when he said all men are created equal, he was only referring to white men. Mm. But even among white men, he acknowledged that there are innate differences among them that are inherited. But nonetheless, the principle of political equality is that we treat people as individuals.
Give us a brief tour of how we came to have this view of the world that so valued the blank slate notion that you say it turned it almost into a religion or a cult. You say that now we're almost like Victorians who treat human nature the way Victorians treated sex. We mustn't talk about it because it would upset the social order. Give us a quick course here in the kind of lineage of philosophers, very quickly, that built this framework around our contemporary minds.
Well, the expression "the blank slate" is often attributed to John Locke, although what he actually said was that the mind was like white paper. But it was really only in the 20th century, I think, that it began to take over intellectual life, and it was understandable why it did. In part, it was a reaction to the bad science of the 19th century that assumed that different races were on different rungs of an evolutionary ladder.
This is a way of pushing back against racism.
It was a response to the empirical discovery that within a generation, immigrants who came from groups that were out of the mainstream, say from Southern Europe or Eastern Europe, within a generation were indistinguishable from Americans or Britons. Mm-hmm. It was a reaction to the erroneous belief that women were incapable of leadership or brain work. And as the first wave of feminism flourished and it became clear, as women became scientists and scholars and took over leadership positions, that the old idea that women were constitutionally incapable of this was wrong, that even though women did occupy a different position, it was clearly because of opportunities that had been denied to them.
So this is a powerful tool, in effect, for bulldozing away a lot of history's leftovers, a lot of inequities.
Exactly. And in fact, I think the ultimate reason that the blank slate became a kind of religious tenet was a reaction to Nazism, which had pseudoscientific theories of inferior and superior races and pure races being contaminated by interbreeding. And that, I think, left an odor on any approach to the human mind that even mentioned biology. So especially in the post-war years, it was like plutonium.
But at this point, you look at it as almost a source of all evil, of intellectual dishonesty, hypocrisy, corruption even, you say. What's the evidence of that?
Well, I think there is hypocrisy when it comes to the blank slate. I start off the book by saying that anyone who's had more than one child knows that children come into the world with personalities. They are not blank slates waiting to be written on by their parents.
But hypocrisy is kind of the least of it. Now, don't get mild on us here. Your book is bold. You say that it is actually cultivating intellectual dishonesty in the discourse of contemporary intellectuals. How? Well, why?
I'll give a few examples. One of them was the one that I mentioned at the outset, that research on parenting and development doesn't even mention an obvious and, in fact, probably a correct alternative, that correlations between parents and children come in large part from the genes. It's almost rude to bring that up even at a scientific conference, whereas you would think that scientists would test every hypothesis that is plausible. Mm-hmm. Another example is that many intellectuals deny that there's any such thing as intelligence. Again, because if there's no such concept as intelligence, no one can have more of it than any other. No ethnic group or race could be superior in that
regard. So it's just something we accumulate through experience, through environment.
Right. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, academics are obsessed with intelligence. It's the number one topic of gossip among them. And of course, people who disdain IQ tests are happy to invoke them when they talk about, say, lead paint lowering a child's IQ by 6 points, mm-hmm. or executing a murderer with an IQ of 62, or for that matter, the presidential qualifications of George W. Bush. Mm. So the position that there's no such thing as intelligence is not one that people, I think, actually believe in their hearts.
Jack Beattie, mix it up with us here a little bit. Steven Pinker is putting a big stick of dynamite under the thinking that is shared by an awful lot of people these days. He makes some pretty stiff charges that come along with it about dishonesty, hypocrisy, even corruption of our contemporary dialogue in intellectual circles, in all circles of life. He even uses this to kind of describe, to my mind, the emergence of Howard Stern. He says that this culture of politically incorrect shock jocks revel in intellectualism and bigotry, emboldened by the knowledge that the intellectual establishment has forfeited claims to credibility in the eyes of the public, i.e. the public knows there's such a thing as human nature, but we're taught to deny it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, Stephen, your critique of the blank slate is just really profound, and especially its political implications for totalitarianism. This has been one of the great coercive myths. We were right on your nature, Mao said, or whatever the idea, you know, new Soviet man. But I think that the problem with this book, to me at least, is you don't acknowledge, you did just now, I suppose, so you do acknowledge, but not sufficiently to my taste, how much through history the argument from nature and from human nature has comported with conservatism, has comported with complacency, the attitude of whatever is right. And that outlook seems to take as natural things that reflect really a truce in history. A truce long ago was struck about, say, the market. And we call the market natural, forgetting that there was a struggle that led to this, and this, our current views, represent that truce. But to me, this comes through most clearly with your discussion of women. And here, I think you rebut these gender feminists with some of their more foolish statements. But, and you say that the problem really has been discrimination. But if you look back at the past, the problem wasn't discrimination. That wasn't what was keeping women from being bus drivers and from writing books and from doing the other things. It was constructions of femininity. It was social constructions, ideas about human nature that said to women, hey, you're a little girl. Don't think of, Virginia Woolf asks us to remember Shakespeare's sister. She dies at the crossroads because no one can take a woman seriously. Think of the centuries of silence because of a construction about human nature, a historically, now as we see it, transient one. Now, that's an example, it seems to me, that shows us how this idea of human nature has been used by the powerful to really limit the behavior of the powerless, and that you're not sufficiently acknowledging just how the bad past and including an ongoing present of arguments from nature.
Steven Pinker, are you binding and gagging us and taking back to medieval reactionary opportunity?
Oh, absolutely not. And I do talk about the fact that that equity feminism was a great moment in human moral progress. It's a movement that I support. It's a movement that I think has nothing to fear from the possibility that men and women aren't biologically indistinguishable, because ultimately it's a doctrine about fairness, about not treating an individual based on any presumptions about how their entire gender does behave or ought to behave. It is true that notions about human nature led to injustices. And it's also true, as I think we both agree, that the blank slate as a doctrine has led to injustices, to coercive social engineering, for example, to blaming of mothers for everything that goes wrong with their children. So the point is that we shouldn't favor a priori either a hypothesis that some trait is due to social constructions or upbringing, or a hypothesis that it comes from genetic differences. We should really try to look at things objectively, see what the data are telling us, and not assume that one hypothesis is morally suspect, and so we should put a thumb on one side of the scale before we even look at the data.
And even if the hypothesis is not morally suspect, could it, in practice, open the door again to, the blank slate was used to oppose monarchy at its most extreme. But can we embrace this without embracing all that came with it before?
Yes, what we have to do is be clear as to what the moral and political principles are that we value, and not adopt an empirical hypothesis about humans because we think it is more palatable. Both doctrines, when incorrect, sometimes even when correct, have been abused and have led to injustices. That doesn't mean we should embrace a doctrine that we know is false because we think it will lead to have political benefits. That's almost a definition of political correctness in the worst sense. Rather, we should figure out what is it, why do we support feminism? Why do we support equality of opportunity? Why do we support social progress? And in each case, I think the argument can be stated without prejudging the nature of human beings.
We're talking tonight with author Steven Pinker about his new book, The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. He's got a big agenda here. Are you inspired or demoralized by Steven Pinker's debunking of the blank slate? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. From Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight with MIT psychologist Steven Pinker, author of the new big book, The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. And the question is, if we buy that human behavior is encoded in our genes, will we still make the effort to improve things for everyone? If the blank slate is fiction, has it been a useful fiction? Has it inspired us to hope for the best in society, or just left us deluded? And if Steven Pinker, well, is he the new Galileo, the wise guy who wrecks our worldview? Should we hang him by his thumbs or welcome his news? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steven Pinker, you quote Chekhov, who says, "Man will become better when you show him what he is like." And you use this to say, let's look at what we're learning from all the new science that's tumbled out in recent decades, at what we've learned about our genetic selves. And when we do that, though it may be fearful at first to leave the old kind of perspective we've had, this will be illuminating, this will be enlightening. Tell us first, give us some examples of what we've learned, what kinds of human behavior are much more rooted in human nature than we've been readily willing to accept.
Well, one guideline is to look at what's universal across cultures. In much of the 20th century, we were told that for just about any trait, there's a culture out there somewhere in the South Pacific or in Africa where they do everything is the opposite to the way that it is here.
And so we're infinitely malleable.
And so we're infinitely malleable, probably beginning with Margaret Mead claiming that in Samoa there was no anxiety or conflict over sex, that people were just nonchalant starting from the teenage years,
just
which clearly turned out to be false. So what we find out is that violence is human universal, and contrary to the myth of the noble savage, that in pre-state societies peoples lived in harmony with nature and with each other, rates of homicide are far higher in the absence of a police and a state than they are with one.
So there's no noble savage, you say?
There is no noble savage. Mm-hmm. Basic human emotions seem to be universal. Love, sense of beauty, anger, jealousy, trust, gratitude. That language is a human universal, and that languages work by more or less the same logic all over the world. We know that differences among humans within a culture have a partial basis in genetics. We know that because of studies of twins, such as the studies of twins reared apart, who had been separated at birth, but when tested in adulthood have astonishing similarities. We know it from studies of the brain that show that there's a complex pattern of gene expression in utero. And so a newborn monkey, for example, has a visual system that's pretty much fully functioning. And we know it from cognitive science that tries to answer the question, how is learning possible? No matter how important learning is, it doesn't happen by accident. Rocks don't learn, and worms don't learn the same things that humans are capable of learning. So there has to be some kind of innate circuitry that does the learning. What must we be equipped with to recognize each other's faces, to learn a language, to figure out what other people are thinking?
So let's say we accept this. How does it – you say let's embrace it because it's knowledge and we have to embrace it. Otherwise, we're deluded. We're dishonest. We embrace it. How does it empower or disenfranchise the kind of dreams humans have had for optimizing society, optimizing the social good? How does it intersect with social ideals?
Yeah. My favorite example is really an old one, and that comes from the founders and the framers of the Constitution, who were human nature junkies. I mean, if you look in the Federalist Papers, and a lot of it is what we would today call psychology. And the key idea was that since humans have an innate tendency towards self-deception — they didn't use those words, but that's the way we would understand it today — people think that they're more more wise, that they're more virtuous than they really are. And therefore, one shouldn't allow a leader, no matter how charismatic, to become an absolute dictator, that one should have checks and balances in a political system so that one person's ambition and lust for power and self-delusion will counter another one. That's the basis of democracy. Mm-hmm. As Madison said, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, no controls on government would be necessary. And you can contrast it with, say, the movement in the 20th century toward revolutions led by charismatic leaders who based their authority on a claim of moral superiority to their rivals, assumed that their repressive measures would wither away and that people would eventually live in a state of romantic cooperative anarchy. Mm-hmm. Now, of the two systems, it's the one with the more jaundiced theory of human nature, namely constitutional democracy, that has had a more humane outcome than one that might at first seem rosier, namely there are charismatic leaders who will lead us to a promised land of anarchistic cooperation.
So match the social system to the facts of the genetic code and the disposition. Jack Beattie, what's wrong with that?
Well, I'm way over my head with this genetic stuff, and it's fascinating as just a sheer amateur to look at it. My approach to things is historical, and looking at things that way, what I notice is that when we talk about inequalities that are rooted in nature, there is usually given to them an authority. I mean, you know, beauty, brilliance, Barry Bonds swing. I mean, those things are, you know, they have a kind of quiddity. They're just there, and by God, we all have to respect them. But I think one of the maneuvers, one of the tropes of conservatism, which I take as the view that there are hierarchies, that there are some people who are better than other people, that there's an order of things, and your job is to know your place. At least since Aristotle, that seems to me to have been the kind of backbone of conservatism. But there's a kind of trope that they use where inequalities that stem from nature, with the authority they seem to have, are under that rubric are put inequalities that stem from society. For example, like disabilities, physical disabilities. Well, that's clearly a limit on somebody, but it's only our ideas, that is the social construction we have about disability, that has kept people until very recently who have serious disabilities from making the great contributions they can make. That is, there's been ideas about nature that their inequalities were just, that's the way it is. Or I think some of this has been true with just feelings about poverty, that, you know, poverty is, it really reflects nature. It reflects the fact that you just weren't lucky in the genetic throw of life, and you wound up where you were. And you know what? Instead of hanging around the house and getting welfare, you should go out and get a job. And that's even been in the law. You know that the person who is poor and indigent needs the incentive, needs to be forced out of the house to go to work. You know, in the old days, the thought used to be that the widow and the orphan needed help, but we've kind of rehabilitated and sort of debunk the whole those ideas of sympathy, because we're saying it's just wrong to that poverty is a kind of you got to do something about it.
So Stephen Pinker, are you willy nilly riding to the rescue of royalists here?
Oh, no, by no means. And in fact, I mean, I think the conservatism that you describe characterizes maybe traditional British conservatism more than say American free market conservatism.
Well, you quote people in here. You quote Thomas Sowell. You quote von Hayek and these people.
Who definitely don't believe that there should be any kind of inherited hierarchy.
Right.
If anything, it's that people's natural abilities should lead them to the positions that make other people want to exchange with them. But notice, I mean, I think a lot of ideas.
What you just said sounds like a genetic entitlement to position.
Well, it's not an entitlement to position. It's just an acknowledgement that if you have perfectly fair system, inequalities are going to emerge. It doesn't mean that you have to ignore them. I mean, you could make the...
You can offset for them.
You can offset them. You can. I mean, in the most extreme case, of course, is being a widow or an orphan, which is a non-genetic condition par excellence. Mm-hmm. So compassion towards widow... widows and orphans would have nothing to do with any kind of belief in genetic differences. But even those that do come from genetic differences, one could say, in fact, as ironically, people like Herrnstein and Murray did, that in the bell curve, that the existence of innate differences should lead to a more socially activist policy of redistribution, that the people at the bottom didn't get there necessarily by anything that they could control, and therefore some kind of redistributive measures are a matter of simple fairness, that it's not that their people are necessarily lazy, but that in some social arrangements they'll just naturally end up with the short end of the stick, and there's no scientific reason not to try to redress that.
Even if it's genetics instead of politics.
Whatever mixture it is, exactly.
Steven Pinker, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a mountain of people who want to join this conversation. Let's invite them in. Dave is on the line. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Good to have you.
I'm very interested in Mr. Pinker's work, and I'd love to pick up his book. I'm a preschool teacher, and I have a unique opportunity to observe, I think, the interplay of genes and environment. And what I'm thinking is that genes and environment are inseparably entwined. A nice analogy might be the double helix of our DNA, for instance. And that the use of such psychology theories or things like that for political purposes is obviously a ruse. What I see is that two people of different genders contribute a different set of genes to their progeny, and the genes are all mixed up, so we don't know precisely how they're going to be sorted out.
For the time being.
Right. It produces a unique individual and...
Dave, I hear you standing up as a teacher, looking at your children and saying, this is a double helix. There's nature and nurture going on here. And I want to go straight at that, because Steven Pinker picks this up in his book. And Steven, you say, well, yes, but we always tend to lean toward the nurture in our side of things, in our modern understanding of the world. And that leaning is out of whack with reality.
Yeah, it's certainly true that nature and nurture can't be disentangled in the world, because no child grows up in a barrel, and a lump of putty brought up in a human household would not turn into a human being. I think you can try and disentangle them conceptually. In fact, that's, I think, the main goal of science of psychology, is to try to figure out how they interact to lead to a unique individual.
But are you not saying that we see an awful lot more nurture at play than science actually suggests, that we systematically, as I read you, you're saying we systematically downplay the human nature factor here?
That's right. I think that people have thought of it as a kind of taboo, and so we've failed to learn what we might be able to learn with a more open-minded attitude. And it's because of, I think, political and emotional baggage that comes with the idea of human nature that I try to separate.
Dave, can you imagine going into your classroom with a much more human nature perspective, talking to parents and saying, well, Johnny's just not got the genetic package to make this work?
Well, that's an interesting point. A lot of people point to groups and differences between groups, race, gender, things like that. And in fact, the real differences, the greatest differences, are between individuals. When I look at a child and I deduce from their behavior that they have a particular temperament, then I'm going to try and encourage my parents not to try and counter that temperament, because it can't be done. It's inborn.
It's what they are, so you'll buy it to that extent. Dave, thanks for your call. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Yes. First of all, I want to say that Jack Beatty is doing a wonderful job, and he shouldn't be intimidated by not having scientific credentials.
He doesn't look the least bit intimidated sitting here tonight, John.
Well, I'm a neuroscientist, and I study neurons at the cellular level, and I also teach graduate and medical students.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, I'd like to comment on Steven Pinker's work, which I know primarily through the book The Language Instinct. And primarily that work is derivative of Noam Chomsky's, and he's popularized it, for which he deserves great credit. But I undertook to teach that to medical students, and I was very enthusiastic about it. But the more I looked into it, though I respect Noam greatly, the more difficulties I really had with hard evidence. And in our field, I'm a biologist. We have very high standards of evidence.
John, cut right to the heart of it, because we've got a lot of people who want to come in, but we want to get the heart of your observation.
I know. Let me pick up on a point that he made before, because in his book, The Language Instinct, the most important biological studies we have on the human brain are the studies of Hubel and Wiesel at Harvard, who won the Nobel Prize for their studies on the visual system. And in his book, The Language Instinct, Stephen really doesn't understand that work, which was a disappointment to me. And he said earlier that a newborn monkey is pretty much born with an intact visual system. Well, that's pretty much true, but not exactly.
Have you read the new book, The Blank Slate, John?
Not that one, but let me continue.
I'm not sure I can, because we've got a lot more. But here's what I want to ask you. I want to get at the heart of this. Are you saying that Steven Pinker doesn't fully understand the genetics he's writing about that back up his worldview?
He doesn't understand the Hubel and Wiesel work, definitely. And I want to say that a newborn monkey is pretty much born with an intact visual system, but not completely.
That's exactly what I said.
As a matter of fact, pretty much is. But let's talk about the details here. If a monkey has one eye go bad, as does a human, then he will lose vision in that eye, and one part of the brain, the one eye will take over both parts of the brain, and an individual will lose vision in the bad eye. But if it is recognized that there's a genetic and environmental interaction, then that can be treated, and both eyes will have vision.
John, I'm going to come in here because we may get too far into monkey vision for most of us to follow, and we want to stay on the primary point which you're making. Stephen Pinker, let me turn to you. I mean, there's a lot that's just been thrown at you. It's derivative, and you don't understand it. But I guess at the heart of it is this questioning about your grasp, your view of the science that supports your critique of the blank slate.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the accusation, because I said it's pretty much complete at birth, and the caller said it's pretty much complete at birth. Mm-hmm. So I don't see what the disagreement is. Incidentally, I discuss more recent work on the binocular sensitivity of cells in the visual system. And recent work by Lawrence Katz has shown that even though it's true that after birth, if you deprive an eye of input, then cells responsive to it will wither, the actual initial distribution of cells that respond to inputs from the two eyes might be genetically determined.
But take us to the field where we can all play here, because we're not all into that particular research. Is there dispute about the science that underlies your thesis here?
I mean, it depends at what level. In the details, absolutely. I don't think there's a dispute on the, at least among people who know the data, on the results on heritability of personality and intelligence. I think there's a different degrees of emphasis on the plasticity of the brain versus the genetic patterning of it. I think
plasticity would mean openness to environmental impression.
That's right.
In other words, the blank slate quality.
Well, the blank slate would be such extreme plasticity that the brain would simply get all of its structure from the environment. And I've never met a neuroscientist who believes that the brain is that plastic. I don't even know what it would mean for a brain to be that plastic. On the other hand, as long as you believe that learning takes place and you believe that all thought and behavior come from the brain has to be plastic, otherwise we'd be permanent amnesiacs. Learning and memory and skill acquisition are another way of talking about the fact that at the physiological level of analysis, the brain has to exhibit plasticity.
But it sounds like you're ready to stand up for the assertion that science now demands that our worldview move on. And John, I'm sorry we didn't have time to get further into that, but we take your challenge from the scientific front here, and we appreciate it. We're talking tonight with MIT psychologist Steven Pinker about his new book, The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. He says we've almost adopted a religion of denying the role that human nature plays in ourselves, in our society. Have we made the blank slate, the promise of infinite human malleability, into a false god? Has an empty intellectual theology made us dishonest, even to ourselves? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University, this is
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with celebrated MIT psychologist Steven Pinker about his new book, The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. Our news analyst Jack Beattie's here, and he says Steven Pinker's ideas threaten to pull us back into the clutches of some very old politics. What do you think? Is Steven Pinker, intellectual darling, speaking the part of Attila the Hun? Are you ready to adjust your worldview to Steven Pinker's cold, hard facts of life, or are you already there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mandy's calling from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Mandy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Real well, thanks, Mandy.
Good. 2 points. First, let us not underestimate the powerful empirical sensation of free will. You know, I think we can't deny the fact that most people experience themselves as appearingly autonomous. So, of course, that takes on an almost religious nature.
So are you saying that helps us deny human nature,
yes,
or that
absolutely.
That's a fact in spite of human nature?
I think it helps us to deny human nature. But I also want to suggest that I'm not sure really how important focusing on genetics and genes and the biology is here, because this debate is really millennia old.
You mean the debate about determinism?
Yes, absolutely. This has occurred since the pre-Socratics, and we don't really know where it takes us. We have, you know, Plato on one end, who takes us to the philosopher king and the peaceful and harmonious society, and then we have Thomas Hobbes, who takes us to the Leviathan and the tyrannical dictatorial government.
And Steven Pinker says Hobbes was right, Rousseau was wrong. Mandy, stand by. I want to get Steven Pinker in on this. Steven Pinker, you're suggesting that science has added something to this debate, that there's a new chapter that's not millennia old. How do you see that?
Oh, absolutely, because for one thing, it's filling in the mechanism. I mean, people used to believe that human nature was in the blood. We now know it's not in the blood. It's in the DNA and in the facts of development prenatal phase.
It hardly matters. It does matter scientifically, but on the other hand, if it's baked in the cake, it's baked in the cake.
But we also, I think, have more sophisticated notions of what human nature consists of. I mean, in the past, there were debates on, are we essentially noble? Are we essentially nasty? Are we plastic? Is it all in our constitution? What the goal of a modern science of human nature is specifying what the learning mechanisms are that make learning possible, how we respond to different aspects of our environment, and learn and change accordingly.
Mandy, does that change the debate, the dialogue in your mind?
No, I challenge that premise just insofar as, you know, look at Plato's entire doctrine was a theory of learning. It was certainly less sophisticated and less biologically based. It was a theory of knowing. So just as Aristotle, his entire philosophy was based on, you know, his assumption of how human beings know.
And understanding the mechanism scientifically doesn't change it in your mind, Mandy?
I think it does. I think it's fine-tuning. I'm not sure that it changes the essential debate here, which is, are we free or are we not?
And you say we're not.
It gets down to, do we want to admit that we're determined, or do we want to maintain that we are autonomous?
Mandy, thanks for your call. Steven Pinker, is there room anymore for the view that we are free?
Yes, no. For one thing, the nature-nurture debate is really independent of the debate of whether there's such a thing as free will or whether we're determined, because just as someone could say it's all in the genes, there's no real choice, it was determined by our DNA, someone on the nurture side could say, well, it's all how we were treated in the first 3 years of life, and we have no choice as adults because it was all stamped into a plastic brain in a critical period early in development. I can't help it. It was the way I was brought up.
Except I hear you saying that the genetic coding pushes well past the experience of those first 3 years, that we're not just the blank slate that can be permanently impressed right then.
Well, indeed, but I'm just saying that the determinism can be either genetic determinism or environmental determinism. I was abused as a child. That's why I blew away with my parents. Depraved on account of we're deprived. So the free will determinism debate is separate from the nature-nurture debate. I believe there is a phenomenon that we refer to when we talk about free will. I think the brain has a complex circuitry that deliberates options, that anticipates the consequences of behavior, that reflects back on how prior choices led to one outcome or another.
From your perspective, is our freedom diminished from the Steven Pinker perspective, or do we live in a more determinist universe when we accept your view?
Well, to some extent, that the subjective experience that nothing is impinging on me, that I could just do whatever I want, whenever I want, should be taken as a datum, as a phenomenon that we want to explain. Why do people have that feeling, and to what extent is it true? And in a great deal of social psychology, it's been shown that people overestimate the degree to which they autonomously make decisions. You can predict an awful lot about how people will behave in a situation that depends on factors that they have no idea about. Just to give a silly example, you give people a bunch of choices. You can say you can have one of these three T-shirts, mm-hmm. and you show them one at a time. And a large percentage of people think, well, that's free will. If anything is free will, that is.
Pick a T-shirt.
It turns out that people will pick the first one that they see something like 70% of the time. You say, why did you pick that T-shirt? No one says it's because the first one you show me is the most attractive. They say, well, I like the color. I like the logo. I like the cut. There are hundreds of examples
and
like that.
And with that, we feel your enlightenment, but also the walls closing in on us here. Well, and no wonder we push back against it. I want to get one more call in here. Steven's on the line. Hi, Steven. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Make it quick, Steven. Our time's running down.
Okay, my essential question is similar to the previous caller. I basically wanted to know if Mr. Pinker has any thoughts on the idea of whether or not personal willed and self-aware self-development may in fact itself be a genetically possible or genetically predetermined trait, kind of on the idea of it's not an either-or, it's not nature or nurture, it's maybe a combination of both, but that it has to be something that is done with conscious will by the individual themselves.
Steven got it. Steven Pinker, can we push back? Yes. Can we push beyond our genetic inheritance?
Yeah. It's important to us. The genes don't control behavior. There's no way for a DNA molecule to pull the strings of the muscles directly. Genes build a brain. The brain is 100 billion neurons connected by 100 trillion connections. It's a complex system. It computes information in real time. It drags up memories. It anticipates what the likely consequences of behavior are. So there's a real phenomenon of coming to a decision, reflecting, controlling oneself. The point is simply that it's not magic. It's not some soul that's separate from our brain or separate from our genes. It's one of the powers of the brain.
It's not a ghost in the machine. It's the machine.
That's right. And we hold people responsible because we want to appeal to those brain systems that do anticipate the consequences of behavior.
Not to some vague spirit. And with that, you bring us to a very contemporary scientific view of human nature. Steven Pinker, there's so much more to talk about, but we're just about out of time. I want to thank you for coming in tonight. It's been great having you.
Oh, it's been fun. Thank you.
Steven Pinker is professor of psychology at MIT and author of The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature. Jack Beatty, there's the brave new world. Are you ready to live in it? What's it mean for us?
Well, I mean, it's an old world in some ways. I mean, my first published article was a paper on Kant, and Kant wrote, out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing could ever be made. But he was not a conservative, nevertheless. He felt that it was the job of society, in the term of Bernard Bosanquet's, to hinder the hindrances that come to it from nature. And I think the that this viewpoint here, some of the people you have, they deny society. They see nature, but they don't see society as something that should try to make up for nature, to hinder the hindrances that come from nature.
Well, and with that, the whole question about how we embrace science and pull it into how we understand society. I mean, as Steven Pinker and his crew continue to roll it out, there's going to be a lot more of that for us to digest, take on board. I'm not sure who it's going to empower. It really depends on how we interpret it.
Yes, a lot of people are uneasy with this Darwinianism as it comes back, but you make it seem as if it has some possibilities for liberation as well.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, a look at the crucial race for the U.S. Senate in South Dakota. This is On Point. Four of the nation's seven razor-tight U.S. Senate races feature a Republican representative hoping to move into Congress's upper house, and each race has become a popularity contest between the House and the Senate. The House member in each of these races has focused on attacking the Democratic-controlled Senate for not passing bills important to President Bush, like the Homeland Security bill. The Democrat fires back by challenging the record of the Republican-controlled House. South Dakota is the site of one of these four Senate races, with the state's lone representative, Republican John Thune, challenging incumbent Democrat Tim Johnson. Tonight we bring you excerpts from the final debate between the two candidates, beginning with a question for Democratic Senator Tim Johnson.
More and more Americans are having a hard time affording health care. What specific steps should be taken to fix that?
Well, we've got health care expense problems across the board, young families and old, and it's health insurance in general. I think that the most solid immediate step we can take is relative to prescription drugs, frankly. That doesn't solve all of our problems, but a main reason why health insurance costs are going up is because of the escalating price of prescription drugs, and that's driving the whole thing upwards. So it seems to me that we ought to do what the Senate is attempting to do and what the 30 senior organizations in America want us to do, and that is to include prescription drugs under Medicare. That's very contrary to what Congressman Thune wants to do. He sides with the pharmaceutical industry and with the two senior groups that are funded by the pharmaceutical industry in supporting a plan that would provide prescription drugs under the HMOs, under the insurance industry. That wouldn't lower prices significantly, and you don't know if you'd even have benefit. So clearly, we had to take the side of the seniors against the pharmaceutical industry. That's not what John is doing, but it's what I'm doing.
John, 1 minute.
That's an amusing answer. The only legislation that has passed that would provide prescription drug coverage for South Dakota seniors is what's moved through the House. Tim likes to blame the drug companies for the Senate's lack of action. The fact is the Senate hasn't done anything to reduce prescription drugs for seniors in South Dakota by $1. The House acted earlier this year, last summer. We've been waiting for the Senate ever since. Our legislation would reduce prescription drug costs for South Dakota seniors by 50%. That is something that seniors across South Dakota have said to me, that that's something they desperately want to see done. The House has acted. We've taken the steps. The Senate, again, is tied up in politics, and Tim likes to blame the drug companies for doing that. The other thing we need to do is create medical savings accounts, association health plans, tax credits to make health insurance more affordable to more people, allow self-employed people to deduct the premiums that they pay for health insurance. Those are all reforms that have been passed through the House of Representatives, again, that stalled out in the United States Senate.
Tim, 15.
John, the Senate has passed reimportation from Canada legislation as well as generic legislation. The House won't even take them up, won't even vote on them. In the meantime, your party has stalled Medicare coverage with a filibuster. We've got 52 votes. It's your own colleagues that are blocking passage of prescription drug legislation.
Time, John, 15.
That is not what's blocking it, and you know it. It's the Senate. You guys wouldn't take it through the committee, the traditional way of getting it done. And the House has passed reimportation legislation, not once but twice.
Next question, we'll begin with Tim for one-minute response coming from Josh Welsh. Josh?
With the situation in North Korea, with hostages in Russia, with, you know, a bombing, for example, in Bali last week, how would you grade Homeland Security on, you know, from A to F, and are Americans safer today than they were 1 year ago?
I think I'd rate American Homeland Security about a B at this point. I think there's much more that we need to do, but I think that we owe a lot of credit to the firefighters, the police, the Border Patrol, the Coast Guard, and so many who've worked so hard with the resources they have available. I serve on the Appropriations Committee, and one of the big next challenges is going to be to pass an appropriations bill for fiscal 03. Belatedly, but to get it out of the Senate and the House to the President's desk will provide the sufficient ramping up of funding for those security issues. We've got a lot of public health agencies in America that don't even have access to the Internet, much less a modern communication system. We need to do more in terms of making sure that we have the vaccines that are necessary. So I think that there are some positive things we're doing. We're in the process of reorganizing the 22 agencies that will fall within a Homeland Security agency. We're not there yet. I think there's about 98% agreement between the Senate and the White House on that. We're caught up with a filibuster yet again because we've got the votes to pass the bill, but we have a filibuster blocking us at this point. But I think that we're going to get there, and it's my hope that during this lame duck session that'll be done.
John, 1 minute.
We passed Homeland Security legislation through the House last summer. The Senate needs to move on it. It's stalled out over there because the labor unions have weighed into this debate. They want to prevent the president from having the same authority that JFK and up to Jimmy Carter and every president since has had when it comes to national security. And that is the flexibility when it comes to hiring and firing and transfers and disciplinary action on matters of national security. The labor unions have the ear of Tim and his friends in the United States Senate, and it's got Homeland Security legislation hung up. They need to pass that. This is an important priority, protecting our borders. There's nothing that we can do that's more important to this country right now. Unfortunately, what's happening in the United States Senate is they're a lot more concerned about protecting the jobs of bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., than they are about protecting our borders. The House moved on Homeland Security legislation last summer. The Senate needs to get together, get this job done soon.
Excerpts from the final debate in the race for the Senate seat in South Dakota between incumbent Democrat Senator Tim Johnson and his Republican challenger, John Thune. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.